we have come to know, what we know about the Earth and our place in the cosmos. And it contains some rather revealing portraits of some of the best-known figures in the history of cosmology, men like Galileo and Newton and Einstein. And it's quite an entertaining and interesting book. Mr. Ferris is the author of three other books. The titles of those are Space Shots. Before that, there was Galaxies, a book which sold over 100,000 copies and was nominated for the American Book Award. And his first book, The Red Limit, won the 1977 American Institute of Physics Prize. Timothy Ferris teaches journalism and astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley. He has also done some work in television. He wrote and narrated the award-winning PBS science special, The Creation of the Universe. His commentaries on science have been broadcast on All Things Considered. And he has recently agreed to serve as the science correspondent for the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. And we are pleased to have him talking with us this morning as we talk about coming of age in the Milky Way. You folks who are listening are invited to call in if you have questions of your own. All you need to do is pick up your telephone and call us. The number here is 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free in the state of Illinois, 800-222-9455. There the exchange is the difference. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Ferris, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you. Fascinating book.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin by asking a question. It's a question that you yourself pose early on when you're noting the long-time fascination of humans for what was going on in the sky. And we're not just talking about idle stargazing. We're talking about, in some cases, some fairly sophisticated observation and measuring. And the question you raise is, why did they bother? Why did they bother?
Well, there are a couple of motives that one can adduce, although there's always to some degree a projection involved here, because we don't have records of, by definition, from prehistoric times to know better what people were doing and thinking. But there clearly was, first and foremost, a practical reason to try to understand and to be able to predict the motions of the sky. The sky, after all, serves both as a clock and a calendar, and its function as a calendar was particularly important even before the invention of agriculture. At the time, even for nomadic peoples in North America, here and there, for instance, there are what are called medicine wheels set up by the American Indians, and these were typically used to the seasons accurately, so that one could, for instance, a tribe that would spend its summers up in a high pasture land where there was a danger of snowed in if one waited until too late into the fall, would use a stone medicine wheel to consult the stars and determine what the date was, so that you could decide when it was time to go down to your cold weather grazing grounds. And of course, once agriculture came along, this use of the sky as a calendar became even more important. And the earliest poets to be recorded, I'm thinking of Homer and Hesiod among the Greeks, have in their poems a lot of practical advice for farmers on how to consult the stars for information on when to plant and harvest various crops. So there was clearly a practical reason. There also seems to have been a political motive for understanding the sky. We find in many cultures, from the Mayans to the other side of the sea, that political power would fall to those at court who could claim and substantiate some kind of understanding of the stars. The old trick of predicting an eclipse, for instance, and using that prediction to frighten people, which was a trick that Christopher Columbus pulled on the Indians at one point, must have found an efficacious spot in many other places and times as well. But in addition to these rather practical motives, I think there's also always been a what I guess you could call a mystical desire on the part of people everywhere to know more about the stars. And it's intriguing to me why that should be the case. now that we're finding out that that our own origins are tied up with astronomical processes, and that we can't really understand the history of our species and our planet without also understanding the astronomical processes that gave birth to the planet.
Mm-hmm. You know, something that I, just to talk about with the present day, something that I find interesting is right at the moment there seems to be a fairly significant popular interest in the topic, and we have several books now. We have yours, which has been very well received. We have a book by a rather noted, is he an astrophysicist, Mr. Hawking?
Stephen Hawking. A physicist, also done work in astrophysics and particle physics. His chair at Cambridge is actually in mathematics, so I guess you could put a lot of labels on him.
He has a book that's on the bestseller list, the New York Times bestseller list, and there seems to me there may be a couple of other books. And I wonder why it is you think that at this time, why people seem to be so interested in cosmology.
Well, these things come and go. There's always a certain amount of waxing and waning of fashion in science as in other subjects. It is interesting. The Providence Journal had an article on this just the other day that the bestseller list does now seem to have some serious books on it. I used to find generally that as a rule of thumb, less than half of the books on the bestseller list would actually be there as books. The others were some sort of a product, you know, they had a celebrity's name on or told you how to diet or something of that sort. And that ratio is up now. There are more serious books of several kinds, and science among them. I suppose that one reason that all these fashions go back and forth is that there are books that you can read the same way that you eat junk food, and they give you temporary gratification, but after a while you start to feel bad, you know. they just don't nourish you. And when that happens, people start looking more to real books for nourishment. And, you know, science is one of those subjects that is nourishing in every sense, intellectually and spiritually.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to talk specifically about some of the story that you talk about here, going back to the beginning and talking a little bit about starting with the Greeks, who seem to have a fairly sophisticated level of knowledge about the universe. At least they understood that the Earth was round, and I imagine they also understood that the planets were in fact round. They managed to come quite close to one thinker came quite close to estimating the circumference of the Earth, and they managed to attain a rather high level of knowledge. The one thing that apparently that they didn't understand or perhaps couldn't quite accept was the idea that, aside from the fact that they had the Earth at the center of the universe and everything orbiting it, was the thing they couldn't accept was the fact that the Earth moved, that it was not stable, and that seemed to throw everything else off. Why is it so important? Why is that an important idea, that the Earth, as well as everything else, moves?
Well, because when you look up in the sky at night, you see the stars trooping across the sky at a rate of about 15 degrees per hour. Now, there are really only two ways that can be happening. Either the stars in the sky are moving, or the stars are standing still and the Earth on which we stand is moving. The Greeks looked at both of these prospects, and the Greeks, by the way, understood, as you say, that the Earth was a sphere, and the flat Earth idea had been on the wane for a long time by then. I suppose I should mention, since children are still for some reason taught in school that Christopher Columbus was out to prove that the world was round, I should mention that's a myth, and that the fact that the Earth was a sphere had been known for 1,000 years before Columbus ever came along. When the Greeks looked at these two possibilities, either the Earth is standing still or it's turning on its axis, it seemed much more reasonable to deduce that the Earth was standing still. The argument that they raised was that if the Earth is turning on its axis, then we here at Athens, they would say, and they knew pretty well the diameter of the Earth, so they could make the calculation pretty accurately. They say, well, we here at Athens would have to be moving toward the east at 1,000 miles an hour all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, you know, how come we're not 1,000 mile an hour winds blowing against us? It's a reasonable argument. I remember hearing the same argument raised out of nowhere in an elementary school class years ago when I was a student there. And to answer it, you need a fairly sophisticated idea of what we call the concept of inertia in physics. That didn't come along till Galileo and Newton. Lacking that physical connection, the Greeks naturally assumed that the Earth was at rest. But it was a reasonable deduction, is my point. It was not a mishmash of mythology or religious prejudice, as we often read in these slanderous dismissals of the Greeks that you find in, I'm afraid, too many textbooks.
Mm-hmm. Well, probably then the next important thing that happened, although there was a lot of time in between, was when Copernicus came along, who was the man who said that, in fact, that the sun is the center of the universe, not the Earth, which was pretty novel. There was apparently one Greek thinker who actually put forth that idea, but was a lone voice and didn't manage to convince too many people.
The idea had been proposed by Aristarchus of Samos many centuries before Copernicus, but as you say, it didn't get very good reception partly for the reasons we've been discussing. It required that the Earth be in motion. When Copernicus proposed his theory, you may recall that he didn't publish it for many years. He was on his deathbed by the time the book came out. And one reason for this, as one reads generally, was probably that he feared religious opposition. But there was another reason as well, and that was that the theory didn't work very well. It had a couple of different problems. One was that the Copernican system was not simpler than the Ptolemaic. Seem to be debunking myths here this morning, but again, one always reads that the Copernican system was so much simpler. It was actually a little more complex than the Earth-centered Ptolemaic system that had preceded it. And after all, it proposed several things that were false. It proposed, as you say, that the sun is at the center of the universe, which it is not. And it also had the planets moving in circular, perfectly circular orbits around the sun, which they do not. So it's true that the world did not immediately jump up and embrace Copernicanism as revealed truth, but it's also true that they had good reasons for hesitating on those grounds.
Hmm. Well, then perhaps the next man we should be talking about is Kepler, and who was the man. His contribution was to say that, well, in fact, the orbits of the planets are not circular. Everything is not based on this perfect sphere. The orbits are, in fact, elliptical, and that's how you can explain many confusing things, including the fact that sometimes planets, instead of that they move back and forth, that they don't move in one consistent direction.
Yeah, the motion of because the Earth is moving in one elliptical orbit, and all the other planets are moving in other elliptical orbits, and these orbits are not quite in a plane, but are tilted relative to one another, a little bit like plates that have been carelessly stacked. When all of those things combined, plus their fact that they change their velocity, moving faster as they're closer to the sun and slower when they're further away, make the observed motions of the planets across the sky very complicated and very difficult to pull together in a single theory. Kepler had been educated as a young man by one of the few young radical astronomers who accepted the Copernican view, and so he was convinced that Copernicus was right from early on, and he then as a professional went on to work with Tycho Brahe, who had assembled marvelous tables showing the motions of the planets more accurately than had ever been done before. Armed with all this, Kepler's task as a theorist was to try to make some sense of it all. And he worked for something on the order of 17 years, depending on how exactly you count the schedule, trying to make sense of this data for just one planet, Mars. And it was, he tried literally hundreds of different forms for the orbit. And the great obstacle he had to overcome was, as you indicate, this ancient presumption that that the circle was the perfect form. You know, it wasn't a bad idea. After all, the Earth was a sphere. The heavens were thought to be spherical. And it seemed reasonable that they would move in perfectly circular orbits, since the circle is the two-dimensional equivalent of the sphere. That proved to be false, and when Kepler finally abandoned it and discovered that the orbits were elliptical, he was rewarded by being put on the path to discovering the laws of planetary motion. As he says in his one of his books, you know, this hypothesis of the circular orbits had been approved of by all the philosophers and seemed metaphysically sound. It was, you know, in many ways the last thing one would abandon. And I think that's a good lesson in science generally, that often what turns out to be a bright idea begins by looking completely nonsensical and sometimes even ugly and repugnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking, by the way, this morning with Timothy Ferris, a science writer, about his book Coming of Age in the Milky Way, a history of astronomy, cosmology, how we came to learn what we know about the Earth and the universe. And questions are welcome, as always, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, if you'd like to be a part of the program. This brings us to two of the most interesting sort of strange characters in the book, and two very significant characters in this history that we're talking about. And I'm thinking of Galileo and then Newton. And you make an observation that I think is quite an interesting one about the way that history has a way of making people into symbols so that the real person tends to be obscured. And you say that for no scientist has that been more true than for Galileo. And you do some more debunking of a couple of myths about Galileo.
Yeah, you know, Galileo was a man who very much wanted to be remembered in history as a great scientist, and he was a great scientist, although that in itself doesn't mean that you'll be, you know, famous or remembered in history. He wanted the fame part, too, and he got that, but he paid a terrible price for it. We do have these images, you know, of Galileo that everyone thinks of him, for instance, dropping the two weights from atop the Leaning Tower of Pisa, to show that they strike the ground at the same time and that the heavier objects do not fall faster, as Aristotle had maintained. Now, you know, actually, if you stop and think about this picture for a moment, you realize that it has to be false. Galileo lived in the Renaissance. This was a time when Europe in general and Italy in particular was swarming with smart people. Many of them were interested in just such mechanical and engineering and even scientific questions as how pulleys work and levers and falling, how falling bodies fall. If all you had to do, you know, was to release two objects of different weight and see that they strike the ground at the same time, then surely they would have figured this out before Galileo. It's not exactly a difficult experiment to perform. The fact is, of course, that it doesn't work. If you drop a cannonball and a, you know, another ball that weighs half as much, a bocce ball, let's say, from the top of the Leaning Tower, the cannonball is going to hit first. The reason is that the wind resistance will act differentially and retard the fall of the lighter object more. Galileo's belief was that objects fall at the same rate in a vacuum, but he couldn't prove this because there was as yet no way of making a vacuum on the Earth. He used inclined planes to roll things down to try to get the experiment more manageable and reduce the effect of air resistance. And these did seem to confirm his belief. But the belief came from a pure thought experiment. And it's kind of an interesting experiment. What Galileo did was to say, let's suppose Aristotle's right, and let's say you've got a one-pound cannonball, and it falls a lot faster than a half-a-pound bocce ball. Now, let's take this one-pound cannonball and saw it in half. Now, according to Aristotle, each of these half balls, since they weigh only half a pound each, should fall a lot slower. So, okay, that's so far so good. But now let's suppose we attach the two half balls back together with a little piece of balsa wood or even just a thread. Now what happens? Does this thing now suddenly think of itself as a 1 pound weight again, start falling faster? Or does it think it's still two half pound balls, so it has to fall slower? And it was in this way that Galileo reasoned out that there had to be that Aristotle's belief had to be erroneous on this point. And then the experiments proved to confirm the thought experiment. So that image of Galileo almost certainly never happened. In fact, there was somebody who dropped some weights from the Leaning Tower, but it appears to have been an opponent of Galileo another 50 or 60 years later.
Who was trying to prove he was wrong.
Yeah, who was saying, here, watch this. You know. And I think that similarly, the other images we have of Galileo are to some degree or another distortions. Mm. But the important thing to Galileo wouldn't have been the distortion so much as that we remember him, and indeed we do.
Well, he doesn't. The picture that you get of Galileo, it seems like he wasn't really a very nice person, or at least the one sort of petty thing he did was apparently Kepler wrote to Galileo asking him, maybe even begging him for a telescope, and Kepler was never a wealthy man, was always rather impoverished, and apparently he couldn't afford to buy his own. And Galileo,
there was no place to buy one yet.
Oh, there was no place to buy one. Okay,
yeah.
So well, at least and Galileo apparently ignored him, thinking perhaps that he was a competitor and a threat.
I don't know what his motives were, but it is true that when Galileo published his book, The Starry Messenger, reporting his fabulous discoveries with the telescope, the book. The great question that was raised was, is this book trustworthy? How do we know, even if we assume that Galileo is telling the truth, how do we know that his telescope actually magnifies objects rather than merely distorting or creating images the way a kaleidoscope does? I've looked through one of Galileo's early telescopes, and I can confirm that it's not at all immediately clear, even to someone like myself who spent a lot of time looking through telescopes, it's not immediately clear that this thing is magnifying a distant object, and is giving you a reliable image. There is a lot of distortion in the image, particularly chromatic aberration, which is false colors introduced into the image. The field is very narrow, and, you know, it takes some training to appreciate what you're seeing through an early telescope like that. And so even people who looked through it had their doubts. And then, of course, for most scientists, there were no telescopes yet with which to verify the observations. So what the point critics made was that the book is all well and good, but can we trust the observations? Kepler, the greatest astronomer of his day, came out for Galileo on this and said that, you know, Galileo is a great scientist, and if he says that this is what he saw through the telescope, then even though we can't yet confirm it, I accept his verdict. And this went a long way toward, as a sort of a jacket quote, if you will, toward promoting the success of Galileo's book, and it was a very successful book. It was being written, people were buying copies of it in Chinese within 2 years after its publication. So Kepler then, as you say, couldn't get a telescope and wrote to Galileo asking if he could at least borrow one, and Galileo never bothered to answer his letter. So yeah, I think in many ways he was not such a splendid fellow, Galileo, but there's a lot of controversy about that. I know there's now a certain amount of academic controversy over my treatment of Galileo, with defenders of Galileo writing irate notes, you know. And, so it's sort of nice to see the old guy's character being called up to question again. And this is, you know, the nature of the figure of a figure as great as Galileo is that we're going to be arguing about him forever.
Hmm. What seems to be interesting is that at that time there were some great rivalries between competing astronomers, and one wonders if that, you know, if that kind of scientific rivalry is a thing of the past or whether it still continues.
Oh, it's definitely not a thing of the past. there are very intense scientific rivalries going on right now. A good example is the question of the rate at which the universe is expanding, which reads out as the age of the universe is well. So it's, you know, it's an important thing to know, and there is one school that excuse me, there's one school that holds that the universe is about 20 million years old, and another that it's roughly half that age, about 10 billion, I think I said million, but 10 billion as opposed to 20 billion years old. And, you know, this is a sufficiently acrimonious dispute that there's some people on two sides that won't even speak to each other, and there's a lot of mutual consternation. But these things in science are generally not solved by having debates or confrontations between people. They're solved by the data. You know, eventually the answer will emerge, quite apart from the personalities or prejudices of the individuals involved.
Hmm. We're talking this morning with Timothy Ferris about his book, Coming of Age in the Milky Way. Our guest this morning is Timothy Ferris. He teaches journalism and astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley and is the author of Coming of Age in the Milky Way, also of three other books, The Red Limit, Galaxies, and Space Shots. He has a lot of experience both in writing and in broadcast. He recently agreed to serve as the science correspondent for the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour and also has done some commentaries on science that have been heard on All Things Considered. His book is about the history of how we have come to know of the nature of the Earth and our place in the solar system and in the universe. And I have a couple of callers here. We'd like to get them into the program.
You know, if I could, you know,
sure.
Just before you do that,
sure.
Because I'm glad you mentioned again about the McNeil-Lehrer News Hour, because that I don't know quite how that got into a press release that went out. I have been discussing doing some stuff with the McNeil-Lehrer people, but we haven't yet concluded anything, so it's really, I probably should say it's premature to be saying that I'm doing that show, because I really don't know yet whether we're going to be able to.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah, yes, I must say my source is the release here from Morrow,
yes.
The publisher.
Yeah, I was out of the country when that release came out, and it's otherwise accurate, but that was a little bit. We're still going back and forth with the McNeil-Lehrer people, and I don't know whether we're going to be doing that or not. So I should say that that's more of that's in the nature of a forecast,
okay.
Like a weather forecast.
Well, then we'll say maybe in the future people will see you on McNeil.
Yeah, as the weatherman would say, I may be in a TV correspondent condition. Isn't that the term they use?
Yeah.
You never want to say it's going to rain. They say a rainfall condition.
Yes, unfortunately too much. Well, let's talk with some of the callers we have here. We'll go first to one of our local lines, line number one. Hello.
Mr. Ferris, I've heard you on several radio talk shows, and I have been tremendously impressed by your extraordinary ability to explain complicated things in terms that laymen can understand. I congratulate you on that.
Well, thank you, sir.
I wish I could read your book, but my eyesight won't permit it.
Well, it's coming out. Actually, it's coming out on audio tape. I've just been listening to the rough cut of the audio tape version. It'll be out on tape in 3 weeks, so perhaps if you get a chance to...
Will it be the whole book?
No, unfortunately. You know, it'll be two full cassettes, and that represents, even then, less than 25% of the total book, which I'm sorry mm-hmm. that's the case, but it is...
Well, 25% of something is better than 100% of nothing. You've heard that joke, I'm sure.
Yes.
My question is kind of a silly one, but every time I hear the title of the book... I wonder if that's any play on the title of the Margaret Mead book, Coming of Age in Samoa.
You know, I guess it must be. But that book came out when I was, I guess I must have just been a little boy. And,
yes, you were.
And I've actually never read it. But I assume that's where I must have gotten it from. It seems logical.
Yeah, that's a good title. Thank you very much.
All
thank
right.
you for calling.
Well, thank you. On to someone else here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Dave.
Hi.
You know, I'll tell you, it devastated me here. I thought Columbus always figured the Earth was flat. No, really, I did. What was the logic behind it? I've got a question besides that.
All right, let me tell you.
Okay.
Columbus's argument was that the circumference of the world is not of 24,000 miles, as had been known since Greek times, but about one-third of that. And every time he found a map or a geography that made Asia closer to Europe by a westward route than it really is, then he would use that argument. He added them all up until he had a very small world. And that's why he was able to argue for sailing west from Spain to China. After all, if he hadn't run into North America, it would have been a doomed trip, even...
When it ran out of everything.
Yeah, you recall that when Magellan's expedition crossed the Pacific, just the Pacific, they suffered such privations that Magellan himself did not survive, but his first in command said that he thought that never again would man attempt to make such a voyage. So that was the argument, and we tend to forget that, I think, because Columbus was wrong, and owing to the halo effect, one tends to always want these heroes to be right about everything. But there is an interesting question that, beyond that, that discussed a little bit in the book, and that is what made Columbus so certain that he was going to find land? I mean, he wasn't suicidal, after all, and he was right. A great sailor. And it's only a guess, but the guess of some scholars is that he must have heard reports, it's one time or another, of the fact that sailors had seen land to the west. And these reports may even have been the old Icelandic reports, which he
was
Viking
too.
Yeah, he was, we know that Columbus once was up toward Iceland.
Yeah.
And he may have, at the monasteries there, encountered such reports. Or they're very, could have heard it, but for some reason he felt confident that if he sailed west for about a month, he was going to hit land. And in that, he was quite right.
Yeah. You know, what I wanted to ask you is a little bit more current. I've heard reports now, and I can't believe it, but the Earth has shifted on its axis slightly, and this is what's creating this drought. Now, can you comment on that?
Yeah, that's false.
Okay.
The Earth does shift on its axis all the time, but the variation is very small. I was looking at a geology text recently, and they had the wandering of the Earth's axis over a period of 1 year on a diagram that took up one page of this normal-sized book. And the reason I mention this is that the diagram was at 100% scale. In other words, a motion of an inch on the page was a motion of an inch in the Earth's axis. And so the variation of the Earth's axis in the course of a year is less than a couple of inches, and it takes a long time for the variation to produce any change in the weather.
When do you expect the next reverse polarity?
That's the most unpredictable event I know of.
Okay.
The caller is referring, I assume, to the the reverse of the Earth's magnetic poles.
Right.
And no one knows what causes those reversals or what caused them in the past. There have been a great many of them in history. There's a current theory that they're triggered by massive meteor showers, but in fact, no one has any idea what causes the magnetic pole to flip from time to time, and that's the last thing I'd want to try to predict.
Okay, it doesn't matter if you're right. It wouldn't matter anyhow. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right,
thank you.
Yep. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. We're talking with Timothy Ferris, author of Coming of Age in the Milky Way. There was so much territory that we have not covered and couldn't possibly do it in the time we have left. But I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about, and again, this is a sort of an impossible kind of task, talk a little bit about two men, Newton and Einstein, that both in their way changed things completely.
Well, these were two virtuosos of gravity. Newton invented the term, well, he didn't invent the term, Aristotle invented the term, but Newton invented a theory that made possible accurate predictions of the outcome of gravitational phenomena, and that includes, the fall of objects on Earth and the orbit of the moon and planets in their orbits. A magnificent theory, still good enough that you can use it, for instance, to fly from the Earth to the moon. In fact, one of the astronauts, I think it was Anders, on his way back from the moon, and one of the Apollo spacecraft was on a phone patch with his little boy, and who asked, "Who's driving the spaceship right now?" And Anders said, "I think Isaac Newton is doing the driving right now." meaning that they weren't, you know, all they had to do was sit there and let the thing fall toward the earth according to Newton's laws.
Mm-hmm.
Newton's theory remained unchallenged until the 20th century when Einstein wrote in his General Theory of Relativity, which is his theory of gravity, wrote a broader account that extends the range of gravitational physics out to the interstellar and intergalactic level, in which Newton's theory appears as a smaller and more special case. And I think it's important to make that point, that these things sometimes get talked about like revolutions, and they do have some revolutionary impact, but you know, it's not a case of Einstein coming along and showing that Newton was all wet. It's more a matter of showing how a broader theory can exist that covers a wider range of phenomena into which Newton's theory becomes a special case. As men, the two were quite different. Newton was a very solitary man who never married, had few friends, was threatened all his working life by the idea that the world would come tumbling in and impinge upon him and cause him to give up his privacy. Einstein, although he was, he once said in a letter that the truly great men are always alone, and although he described himself as a wandering bohemian without a home anywhere in the world, was a more personable and witty and charming person than Newton. But the two, you know, there's a lot of affection from Einstein to Newton, and Einstein in his so-called autobiographical notes, in which he dutifully tries for two or three paragraphs to say something about himself personally before lapsing into pure science for the rest of the book, critiques Newton at one point, and then says, "But enough of this. Newton, forgive me. You did all that you could with the tools available to you in your day." And I think Einstein realized that he was doing all that he could with the concepts available in our time as well.
You find that as you read about some of these men, that they were real characters, and that they were interested in a great many things. There's a quote in the book talking about Einstein in his early years, perhaps before he became as famous as he was to become, that he resembled a poet as much as a scientist. And I wonder whether you feel that's, you know, somehow to do great science, or perhaps to think about things that others have not thought before, you have to be different.
Well, you know, yes, and also, you know, Einstein was a cultured man. He was a product of a European culture that's harder for us to remember now than for us to believe in than it was when it flourished. Einstein warned before the outset of the First World War. He said, "This is not a comedy. This is the greatest tragedy in the history of human affairs. A world war will be the wreck of European civilization." We tend to think that the predictions like that were overwrought because, after all, Europe is still there. But actually, my impression is that they were fairly accurate. The two world wars did wreck European culture. What was left behind is just the shattered remnants of what once was there. So if you had gone to visit the young Einstein when he was a patent office clerk, third class, and in Bern, and living in his little walk-up flat with his wife and their little child, you would have encountered a young man full of energy, quick to laugh and tell jokes, enormously widely read, who wanted to talk about philosophy, poetry, history, music, pick up a violin and play, give you a violin and expect you to be able to play a duet. Einstein, in fact, once heard a piano that he liked coming out of a window, and he had his violin with him. He ran up and in the open door, all the doors unlocked, notice, in the middle of Bern, ran up in through the door. Here was an elderly lady playing, pulled out his violin, said, "Don't stop playing," immediately started playing along with her. it's a different world. And in that world of a supremely civilized man, science played an important but not an exclusive role. And there are scientists today who still understand that and who are widely cultured, but unfortunately there are many younger scientists, particularly students, who are so driven in the pursuit of their craft that they're not given a chance to have the broader acculturation that someone like Einstein took for granted.
Mm-hmm. It seems to say that perhaps at its highest level, science is not a pure activity in the sense that it's exclusive, that something about it involves integration of a lot of different things, and that it's a matter of seeing. You talk in the book about symmetry. I think it's a matter of seeing patterns that exist everywhere, and perhaps in places where some people wouldn't think of looking.
Yeah, and the more awake you are in every field, the better you're going to do in one particular one. So as you're indicating, the search for beauty and a taste for for what counts are very important in science. That was one of Einstein's great assets. He could shuffle through all sorts of hypotheses and seize hold of a promising one based on little more than his intuition as to how nature or physics, if you like, really works and what rings true and false. He wasn't always right about this. Like, he'd make mistakes like anyone else, but he had great taste as a physicist, and that's important. You can't do science just by rationally making deductions. Hmm. Computers can do that.
Our clock is starting to run down here. I have another caller as well I'd like to try and include here on our line number one. Hello.
Line one?
Yes.
Two quick questions. First of all, what did you say as to the reason we don't feel a wind from the east due to the rotation of the Earth?
Well, I said that the Greeks couldn't answer that question until they had a more complete concept of inertia. I had in mind, the Greeks thought of inertia as the tendency of an object at rest to remain at rest. They didn't all extend that to the idea that an object in motion continues in motion. If they had had that second conception, they might have been able to determine that the Earth's atmosphere, since it is being moved along by the Earth itself, will tend to keep moving.
I would think there would be slippage, though, between the Earth and the...
There is some. It's called and it does produce some trade winds, but it doesn't give you, 1,000-mile-an-hour gales.
Hmm. Okay, second quick question. If, say, the Big Bang was 15 billion years ago and everything started from it, how can anything at the present time be more than 7.5 billion light-years away?
Well, it can be up to 15 billion light-years away because the expansion rate at the distant galaxies is almost that of light.
But it takes time to go out. It would take as long to go out as it does if it all started from one place to begin with. It'd take,
I see what your question is.
7 billion years to go out and then 7 billion years to come back.
So it doesn't have to come back, just a one-way trip, because the Big Bang didn't start from one place. It started at all places. So it started right there.
It was an infinitesimally small...
It was, yeah, but that infinitesimal point contained all of cosmic space as well. So it was, that point was right there where you are talking on the phone. It was right here where I am. And it was also, at a galaxy 10 billion light years away. The distribution of all those points from cheek and jowl coexistence to being scattered across the universe as they are is the definition of expansion.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, we have about a minute or so left. There was one other thing that I wanted to ask. And in the book, you spend a good deal of time talking about quantum physics, this study of what is going on at the subatomic level.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that this point where we are, the late 20th century, might be remembered in history of science as the time when particle physics, this study of the smallest structures in nature, joined forces with cosmology to study the universe as a whole. What do we gain from combining this study of the smallest things with the study of essentially what is the largest thing?
Well, as our previous caller was mentioning, the universe is thought to have begun as an infinitesimal point and to have evolved from a state of high density and energy into the state we find it today. Now, astronomers can can deal pretty much with the universe as we find it today. But when you go back and you want to look at the very early universe, you're dealing with conditions that are more like those inside a nuclear bomb or inside a star. And the physicists, the particle physicists, are the experts in those kind of extreme conditions. So they've been linking up with cosmologists to try to understand what went on very early, during the first fraction of a second, the first few minutes, the first million years of the expansion of the universe. And that's, it's a fertile field because most of the fundamental things that ever happened in the universe, most of the really important cosmic transformations seem to have happened during those first brief moments. And the better we can understand those, the better we can understand how the universe got to be the way it is today. One promising school of theory is the supersymmetry theories. Imagine that the universe began in a higher number of dimensions as perhaps a 10-dimensional structure in which six of those dimensions collapsed out due to instabilities at the very beginning. And the debris of those collapsed dimensions may be nothing other than all the quanta of matter and energy and space and time that we see around us. So it's a very promising field of investigation.
There seems to be a strange irony that at least some of what we know about the mechanics of the universe and how stars work and so forth came out of the research that resulted in nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it is. The story told in the book that when Darwin was on the voyage of the Beagle, he formulated the first accurate theory of how coral reefs form. And he expressed the hope that one day someone would be able to dig a hole down far enough into a coral reef to see whether he was right. If he was right, they would find volcanic material at the base. And that experiment was finally conducted around 1950 by American drillers, and they turned out that Darwin was right, but they weren't drilling into the coral to verify Darwin's theory. They were testing the structure of the coral atoll because they were about to blow it up with the first hydrogen bomb. There was Einstein, remarked about that in a striking remark, that man grows cold faster than the planet he inhabits. It's a very interesting line because the planet is heated by radioactive processes, and yet what we have done with our knowledge of those processes has not as yet promised a bright future for our species.
Well, I'm afraid that we will have to leave it at that, and we have just barely scratched the surface of what is in the book, and I really recommend it. It's quite a fascinating book and very readable, and I thank you for spending some time with us.
Good talking with you.
Our guest this morning, Timothy Ferris, and if you are interested in what we've been talking about, take a look at his new book. It's entitled Coming of Age in the Milky Way. It's published by William Morrow and Company.